And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Peter Fitzsimons. Peter is Australia's best-selling non-fiction writer. For the past 35 years, Peter has also been a journalist and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sun Herald. He's the author of a number of highly successful books, including Monash's Masterpiece and biographies of Breaker Morant and Douglas Mawson. Peter is a passionate Australian who has represented his country on the rugby field. He is also passionate about telling stories of great men and women contributing to stirring events in Australian history. Peter's latest book fills that description to a T. It is The Incredible Life of Hubert Wilkins. Peter, welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
Bill, nice to talk to you, and thank you. I enjoy having a chat to you every year or so.
Thank you. Well, you describe Hubert Wilkins' life as incredible, and if I had to compare his exciting adventures, I would be thinking of Forrest Gump or the Flashman books, but they were fiction. Why are we only now hearing about this fellow?
It's a very interesting question, yes, and I've called in my intro to the book, I said that Hubert Wilkins is the Forrest Gump of history because he just keeps popping up at these extraordinary moments. But in answer to your first question of why we haven't known much more about him, he and I, if I can put myself in the same breath, are at opposite, well, in a negative fashion, we're at opposite ends of the spectrum. I'm a ruthless self-promoter. He was a ruthless suppressor of his reputation at one point when Sir John Monash, the great Sir John Monash, referred to him in the public domain and said Hubert Wilkins was the bravest man in my command, which from an Australian general that, you know, was in charge of, I think it was in the end, you know, something like 250,000 Australian soldiers, to say this is the bloke that was the bravest I had is extraordinary. And Hubert Wilkins, instead of going, you know, wacko the diddly, oh, that's fantastic, thank you, did you hear what John Monash said about me, contacted him and said, Sir John, please don't say things like that. You had men that won the Victoria Cross under your command. I'm embarrassed by that. I just want to get on with my life. You just go, wow. The other thing is that, well, I think perhaps best is for a lot of your listeners will go, Hubert who? Which is what most of Australia, perhaps I could just, instead of the 203,000 words I've done for the biography, I could give a thumbnail account of his life. Would that be all right?
Yes, please.
Okay, born in Whoop Whoop, South Australia, remote South Australia on the edge of the desert, youngest of a very large family on a family farm suffering from drought. He journeyed to Adelaide in his early teens when the farm went bust through drought and became interested in mechanics and worked out how, and also with his farm experience, how to start an engine that wouldn't start. There was a travelling show going through that had this new thing called cinematography where they could put flickering images of leopards running through the jungle. The engine buggered up. He said, I can fix it. He did fix it. They said, you want to travel with us? He said, yes. So he goes with this travelling show, comes to understand cinematography, camera work, gets to England. When he gets to England, there's a certain ship called the Titanic, just pulling out as his ship pulls in. He's able then to understand aviation, and he was the first one, and this was typical of him, to put different skills together. So by this time he understood engines, he understood camera work, and once he understood aviation, he said, well, why don't I put the camera with a plane and fly over battle lines? And he became a great great cameraman for the newsreels. That's where the big money was. If you got images of wars, people would pay big money to see it. So he goes, flies over the Balkan flies over the Bulgarian-Turkish war, gets footage there. He's then contacted, do you want to go to exploration in the polar regions? He goes for 3 years. He's the last man on board of 30 people. He becomes the second in command because he's so extraordinary in his abilities, understands how the Inuit people live. He gets their skills. How do these people live off, not off the land? How do they live off the ice? How do they stay warm in 40 degrees below zero? He gets all these skills. He's then told, after 3 years of isolation, there's a great war going on. Australia's involved. He gets back to Australia and he goes to a, they say, well, you know, he says, I want to be a soldier. They say, well, you have to do a physical. They said, no, your legs are buggered, you can't walk. He said, I've just walked back from the North Pole, effectively. Well, the polar regions, at least. So they say, well, you can be a cameraman with Charles Bean. So he, Frank Hurley and Charles Bean, then chronicle the Australian experience on the Western Front. He frequently puts down his camera, charges out, and rescues soldiers and is nearly killed nine times. He, at one point, well, he's wounded nine times, but he becomes famous, legendary for taking risks and surviving. He go, after the war's over, he accompanies Bean to go to Gallipoli to chronicle what's left of the, where the trenches then were. During the war, he's there when the Red Baron comes down, the only journalist there, to take the images of the Red Baron. He does the funeral of the Red Baron. He's the only correspondent there at the Battle of Le Hamel, the only one there for the Battle of Villers-Bretonneux, out there with the soldiers taking footage. He then, after the war, I said, goes to Antarctica. He does a two-year trek across the top of Australia. He's there when Sir Ernest Shackleton dies. He's on an expedition to Antarctica with Sir Ernest Shackleton. He goes to interview. He becomes a spy for the British government. He does one of the last interviews with Vladimir Lenin. Then he says, I think I can fly a plane over the top of the world. And he tries once, he tries twice, and fails 2 years running. The third year he does it. He flies from Alaska over the top of the world, lands in Norway. He's on the front page of the New York Times 3 days running. And then he says, I think I can take a submarine under the polar ice cap. They said it couldn't be done. And he had a sort of pretty much a mutiny on board, but he didn't go right. He didn't go, in fact, under the North Pole, but he did take it briefly under the ice to show it could be done. And he just had this extraordinary life and took so many risks, but they were calculated risks, endlessly modest, and he was one of ours.
Well, if you think that's a lot to pack into 70 years of life, there's actually a lot more in the book. All of it is extraordinary. Now, well, first of all, he was called most of his life by his first name, George. Yep. For some reason, he changed it to Sir Hubert.
Well, I can tell you why, because when he was knighted by King George after his expedition across the top of the world, his journey across the top of the world, his name was George Hubert Wilkins, and he thought it was sort of impolite to become Sir George at the hands of King George, so he said, call me Sir Hubert, and that was where it started.
Ever self-deprecating, wasn't he? And you mentioned how he was good at anything he tried, but he was also extraordinarily lucky, wasn't he? I mean, he walked away from a firing squad after being lined up three times.
It was like a lucky charm, if you want to put it like that. I mean, well, but look, part of it was a lucky charm. Part of it was that he was just brilliant at working out. You know, it's one of those things, if you've got 1 minute to live and you've got to do something in 5 seconds, use 55 seconds to think about what you're going to do and act in the last 5 seconds. And to save yourself, and he was very calculated and going into everything. He would have plans and backup plans for his backup plans. He was extraordinarily hardworking. Now, Bill, if you and I were to fly, in the unlikely event that you and I were to attempt to fly from the north of Alaska across the polar regions and land in Norway, we would have one chance, and that would be that the engine didn't bugger up and we both knew how to fly and to navigate. He had one of his backup plans. He had lived in the polar regions for 3 years, and well, in fact, by the time he did it, for longer than that. He had the skills of the Inuit people. He could live off the ice. He knew how to keep warm. He knew how to jump from ice floe to ice floe. He knew how to judge where crevasses were, and so he built up these extraordinary skills. And his plan was, if I come down with his co-pilot, Ben Austin, if I come down, I'll bloody well walk out. And he bloody well might have. You know, he had that confidence. And one of the things they all said about him was hardest working bastard that ever lived, no matter who he was with. You know, Shackleton, Stephenson, the great Icelandic American explorer, they all, or Monash, or any of the, or Charles Bean, they all affirmed that no matter how early they got up, Wilkinson was, I'm married to Wilkinson, sorry.
Wilkinson. That's an adventure too, but we won't go there.
Wilkins was up before anybody, working harder for longer, and was still working when everybody went to bed. He was a supremely hard worker. He kept prospering because there was a quality of assemblage about him, in the sense that with every new experience, he would get new skills and put those skills together. And as I say, you know, the skill of being able to live off the ice was a very useful skill later on for when you're flying over the ice. And when he first went with Stephenson into the polar regions toward in the Arctic, that was where he first learnt the art of navigation, of taking readings from the sun, using compass bearings and so forth. And then that was in 1913, 14, 15, and 16, and that ability to navigate, which was a key skill, was what he also used when he's flying across the top of the world and he's in the polar regions where the compass doesn't quite work and you have to endlessly calculate, make allowance for where true magnetic north is and all the rest. He became ever more skilled as life went on.
He was always keen to learn. He even had his Davy Crockett moment when he wanted to learn how to fight a polar bear with just a knife.
Yes. That's a great story, isn't it? I mean, can I ask you, Bill, what did you think of the book?
Oh, it was there was something on every page. There was just so much to absorb and actually, I suppose, lessons to learn too, because he never let catastrophes and disasters and things going wrong didn't stop him. He just kept going.
It's interesting you mention that, because one of the things Charles Bean said, Charles Bean was the great Sydney Morning Herald correspondent who became the great architect, if you like, or driving force of the Australian War Memorial, and Charles Bean conceived that in the last years of the war, that instead of just being a correspondent for the Herald day by day reporting on various battles, I need to start chronicling all of the Australian experience, collecting artefacts. We're going to build a monument to the 60,000 Australians that died in this war that will be there for perpetuity. And so Bean, one of the things that Charles Bean said about Hubert Wilkins was, he's the only man I've ever met who's lived the life that was reflective of Rudyard Kipling's famous poem, If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to you, hold on. Yours is the world and everything that's in it, and what is more, you will be a man, my son. That's just a bit of a garbled burst of that poem. But if you go through the lines of those poems, if you can talk with crowds and not lose your virtue, if you can walk with kings, not lose the common touch, there's everything in that poem is the way that Hubert Wilkins lived his life.
Look, on that note, we might take a short break. At this stage of the program, Peter, we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which one you've picked?
I love... So John Lennon once said, before Elvis, there was no one. I reckon after Bob Dylan, there was no one. for me, obviously great singers, but for me, Bob Dylan is my guy. And I love this one, which is Bob Dylan basically singing about getting older. It ain't dark yet, but it's getting there.
Shadows are falling, and I've been here all day. It's too hot to sleep, the time is running away. Feel like my soul has turned into steam. I've still got the scars that the sun didn't nail. There's not even room enough to be anywhere. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. And my sense of humanity has gone down the drain. Behind every beautiful thing, there's been some kind of pain. She wrote me a letter, and she wrote it so kind. She put down in writing what was in her mind. I just don't see why I should even care. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. And I've been to London, and I've been to Cambridge. I followed the river, and I got to the sea. I've been down on the bottom of a world full of lies. I hate looking for nothing in anyone's eyes. Sometimes my burden is more than I can bear. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there.
And that was Not Dark Yet by Bob Dylan, specially chosen for us today by our guest Peter Fitzsimons, who is the author of a new book called The Incredible Life of Hubert Wilkins. Peter, you know, we've talked about the nature of our man, Sir Hubert, and there are many highlights, but I also like the story that he received honours in after the First World War that were normally only given to combat people.
And he was the only, in fact, the only correspondent in the First World War, the Great War as it was then known, that was so honoured. And it was because, I mean, he had the respect of the diggers. So when they were about to charge out over, he was famous for jumping out before them, taking the image as they, you know, as they'll come over the top. And one of his reckonings was, the Germans are decent people. They'll see that I'm not armed. They'll see that I'm a photographer. They're not going to shoot me in their back. And muchly. He was right, but on other times, he would, you know, there's a famous occasion when he was taking his tripod up a hill to record a battle, and there's a shell coming, and the shell lands just beneath the tripod, buries itself in the mud, and doesn't explode. Wilkins looks at the sergeant who's been accompanying him, lifting the tripod. Wilkins looks at the sergeant. The sergeant looks at him without a word. Wilkins lifts up the tripod and, or with the sergeant, they head further up the hill to get another image of the battle. When you're a photographer, there's a sort of an ethical thing when you're recording. Are you there to chronicle or are you there to help? I mean, basically, you're a non-combatant. But Wilkins, it's an issue photographers have faced over the years of what is your actual role? What comes first? Surely, if you're seeing somebody drowning, you know, on Bondi Beach, and you have the capacity to save them. You don't just keep filming. You've got to put down the camera and get involved. But in wartime, it's a bit more problematic. But in Wilkins' case, he frequently put the camera down and got involved and rescued wounded diggers. But on one occasion, he put the camera down and led them, and led 30 soldiers, including Americans, that had lost their officer, and led them brilliantly into routing the Germans. So he was awarded the Military Cross with Bar, which to you and I means basically the Military Cross twice, which was an extraordinary, and many thought he should have got the Victoria Cross for some of the things he did. And as I say, he was so legendary among his contemporaries for his capacity to survive come what may, that when Bean took him to Gallipoli straight after the war with six others, and they were traipsing all over Gallipoli and recording and chronicling and gathering artefacts for the war memorial that was then being planned, getting bayonets, getting buttons, sometimes getting bones, and sometimes they would have to walk through the infamous minefields at Gallipoli. And Bean recorded that Wilkins was so legendary for his ability to survive, that they'd say, all right, George Hubert, you go first. You put your right foot there, we're going to put our right foot there. You put your left foot there, we're going to put our left foot, because, nothing could kill this bloke was the reckoning. And they were right up until the time that he turned 70 and died, oddly enough, in a Boston hotel room.
Yes.
From a presumed heart attack.
You wouldn't expect that after all those adventures he'd die in such a quiet manner. But
although I'd say, Bill, the arc of his life, if you think how extraordinary it is that somebody who was born in Whoop Whoop, South Australia, to South Australian family. In fact, he was born before Australia was Australia. He was born in the colony of South Australia on the edge of the desert, should, in the course of his life, become so revered after he died. His ashes were taken beneath the sea by an American nuclear submarine, which surfaced at the North Pole, and the captain personally made a speech and scattered his ashes to the polar winds at the North Pole, making a speech about, this is Hubert Wilkins, this is Sir Hubert, this is what he meant to us. And isn't that an extraordinary arc of a life, that you should be born to a farming family in South Australia and end your days, your physical remains, scattered to the polar winds at the North Pole? What an extraordinary life story.
Yes, I mean, he started off, he was one of 12 children. I think he might have even been the youngest to get away from that start and to be revered in all these places. But his adventures were mainly off the mainland. He did have a project in Australia, but he wasn't really a fan of Australians themselves, was he?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons, too, that he was looked askance a bit by his fellow Australians at the time. I mean, one of the things was that when he journeyed across, I mean, this is a real sad commentary on our nation, that only 135 years after colonisation of Australia by the white fellas, the British Museum looked at Australia and went, Jesus, the white fellas are wiping out a lot of species there. We better get somebody over there to collect a lot of these species of plants and animals and birds before they're extinct. And they got George Wilkins, and he trekked over there with a team of fellow explorers, particular experts, paleontologists and all the rest, across the top of the North Australia. And sometimes Wilkins was first contact with the people of the First Nations. And he was critical of the way that people of the First Nations were being treated. And that didn't go around down well with Australia at the time. But yeah, for me, I guess what attracted me as a storyteller is the diversity of experiences, the twists and turns in the road, and indeed on the ice and in the air, that he saw. He met everyone, did everything.
And he gave Charles Kingsford Smith the plane to cross the Pacific?
That's the thing. I mean, people say, where did I come across him? And the answer is that when I was doing the book on Douglas Mawson, the Sir Douglas Mawson, that Shackleton was a part of that. I just saw the name. George Wilkins was there when Shackleton died, and I didn't think particularly much more about it. But then when Kingsford Smith came along, and I saw that when Kingsford Smith had to pull out of the Great Centenary Air Race, which was the race between England and Australia in 1919, King Richard Smith pulled out, who would replace him? Well, that was a guy called George Wilkins. Then when Kingsford Smith, 7 or 8 years later, needed a plane to fly from America across the Pacific to Australia, who did he buy it from? What became the Southern Cross? That would be a plane from George Wilkins. Then when I was doing, you know, Monash's masterpiece, Wilkins was there everywhere. Villers Bretonneux, Wilkins was there. You know, so the name just kept popping up. And I think it was 2007, a mate of mine, Simon Nash, wrote a book called The Last Explorer on Wilkins. And I said to Simon, that is such a brilliant story. I'm giving you 5 years start, mate. And in fact, I gave him 14 years start. But Simon, with supreme generosity, I took him out to lunch with my key researcher on this book, Angus, and my cousin Angus Fitzsimons. And at the end of it, Simon took us to his car, and out of the boot came two huge boxes filled with documentation on the life of Wilkins, a great act of generosity from one author to another. And there's a guy also, I want to credit, Jeffrey Maynard, who's done a lot of very fine work on Wilkins in a totally different fashion to the way I do stuff. I what I like to do is to work with several researchers and go hard, go deep, go wide, but tell it in the manner of a novel. And that way is not the manner for everybody. But, you know, there's been a lot of people that have been interested in Wilkins over the years. I'm hoping this will put the story of Wilkins before a mass audience.
Yeah, he's been described as the luckiest, bravest and most extraordinarily active man in history. And I think...
I reckon there's something in that. I mean, when I did the book on Captain Cook, Captain James Cook, I think at the end of that book, from memory, I said, you know, I made the point that in terms of a set of eyeballs, Cook saw more previously uncharted coast than anybody who'd ever lived. And I say that with great respect to the indigenous peoples in the Pacific and wherever he went, you know, that had lived there for a long time. When he went up the east coast of Australia, of course, his eyes weren't the first eyes to see the east coast of Australia. Indigenous people, First Nations people, have been seeing it for 65,000 years. But in terms of exploring uncharted coast and actually tracking it on a map, well, Cook saw more than anybody ever. And then when Wilkins came along, Wilkins saw not just uncharted, but saw more coastline that had never been seen by any human eyes, more than anybody ever lived.
Well, we've talked about a lot, and there's an awful lot more, I can assure you, in the book with the story of the incredible life of Hubert Wilkins. Unfortunately, we've run out of time today, so I just want to give a special thank you once again for Peter Fitzsimons for joining us on Dad's on the Air. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks indeed, Bill. I appreciate the chat.
And don't forget, if you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. Send us an email, we'll be in touch, and follow us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.